Welcome to The Creative Shift. My name is Dan Blank, author of the book Be the Gateway and founder of WeGrowMedia.com. All right, I have a really fun and amazing episode today. I'm interviewing Steve Sansweet, and let me back up. This podcast focuses on the idea of the creative shift, where you intentionally, for a reason that is artistic or a mission that you have, decide to make a big shift in your life, to make a big risk, to do the work that you love, to take a different path. Now, usually I'm interviewing writers and illustrators and designers and musicians. Steve Sansweet runs what is called Rancho Obi-Wan, an interactive museum of Star Wars memorabilia. What that means is that Steve has the world's biggest collection of Star Wars stuff. So much so that he had to create a museum just to be able to show it off and give people an experience around it. Why did I have Steve on the program? One, because I'm a fan of his and also of Star Wars, but because his story really illustrates so much of what I try to cover on this podcast. For decades, he was a journalist working mostly for the Wall Street Journal, and then he made a huge shift midway through his career because on the side, for years, starting honestly years and years before anyone else had this on their radar or most other people, he began collecting Star Wars memorabilia, posters and toys and prototypes and props and anything you can think of. He was doing this right after the first movie came out. And while a lot of people figured this out much later in life, in the 90s and 2000s, all through the 80s, he was collecting and taking out second mortgages to collect, when this was not something that we see today, where now everyone has like nerd culture and, you know, there's the Marvel movies. This type of thing is really celebrated. Back then, it was something that, we talked about this in the interview, it wasn't a known thing. It wasn't something celebrated. Quite frankly, it was sometimes the opposite, something where people judged you negatively for it. So we talk about the huge creative shift he made in his life from working as a journalist to doing this work essentially full-time. He ended up moving into Lucasfilm as the director of content management and head of fan relations. He has written books about Star Wars collecting. We go to a lot of amazing places in this interview, and it's so inspiring to me to see how someone takes an interest of theirs and pursues it despite the risk, despite potential negative social outcomes, despite the financial risk at the time, and turns it into something that isn't just self-satisfying, but the work that he's done has really helped create and connect an enormous community of people around Star Wars. All right, here is my interview with Steve Sansweet. Hey everyone, this is Dan Blank. I'm very excited to be chatting with Steve Sansweet. Welcome.
Thank you, Dan. Nice to be here.
So there's a lot I want to cover. I really, you know, this podcast is called The Creative Shift, and I'm fascinated by the career shift that you made and all that went into that. And I want to dig into that. Something I think about a lot, and maybe it's my age, I'm 47, so I was 5 when I saw Star Wars. And I remember, I'm going to say it was the 90s. And it was that first time where someone mentioned, like, you like Star Wars too. And I was like, when I was growing up, Star Wars was water. Everyone liked it. It was like liking Jaws or liking The Shining. I didn't get that it was becoming an identity for people my age who are growing up. You sort of famously have this amazing collection, and you seem to have seen this before a lot of people. I mean, I want to say before anyone, but I'm sure that maybe the reality of the collector market was much more nuanced than that. What was that first way in? Because I'm fascinated with this idea of someone who sees something and is drawn to it. And for me to say, oh, I love Star Wars, I collect the toys, that's a normal thing. Am I wrong in thinking that this was a very unusual thing when you were starting?
It was a very unusual thing on many levels. First of all, in the toy collecting or the collecting market, pop culture was not a big thing to collect back then. It's only been a phenomenon that really started in the 90s. And back then, toy collecting, I was interested in toys. I grew up playing with toys, loving science fiction and fantasy. I did a front page story for the Wall Street Journal when I was a reporter in the Los Angeles Bureau about old toy collecting. Well, basically, old toy collecting, I mean, they sort of stretched it, but for a lot of collectors and the wealthy people who were in the hobby, and those were most of the people who were in the hobby, it was toys before the turn of the century. And it was the 19th century. So toys, but people were accepting toys that were in up to maybe the 1920s and the old arcade cars and the tin windups from France and Germany and things like that. And slowly it became maybe toys up until World War II or that vintage era, but it was always vintage toys. There were some people out there though who were very much attuned to pop culture and liked pop culture. And they were not the kids who didn't have any expendable income, but they were some of the older folks who liked some of the stuff. But still, it was mainly the old toys. I had started collecting 1950s and 60s and 70s Japanese space toys, the rockets and the robots, the fantasy toys and the real world toys. They did Apollo toys and Gemini toys and things like that. I loved the space race. I used to cut out newspaper headlines about the space race and still have some of them. But it was the toys that really got me excited in the 70s. And I started as a collector, but realized that everything I wanted was always $100 more expensive than I could afford. And it was the dentists and doctors and lawyers and ad people who were buying all those really cool toys and had the neat collection. And then Star Wars came. And Star Wars, I saw Star Wars on the back lot of 20th Century Fox, an invitation from the publicity people at Fox. They finally understood what they had on their hands a few weeks before Star Wars opened and invited the journalists from Los Angeles, business journalists mainly, but a lot of journalists, to see it about a week and a half before it opened, before all the hype started. And I was blown away. I mean, it was something after all reading science fiction books all my life growing up in that milieu, I was 31 years old, so I'm older than the kids who first saw Star Wars when they were 5 and 6 and 7. But I loved the movie, and I remember going up afterwards and talking to the publicity guy and saying, could I have the souvenir ticket back that I handed in when I came in? And that was one of my first Star Wars items, and of course I still have it today. So it was a little bit different back then. And as these kids grew up and they had disposable income, and a lot of them will tell you it's partly people thank me and blame me for a book that came out in 1992 called Star Wars From Concept to Screen to Collectible, which was the first book was published through the auspices of Lucasfilm, though I was still at the Journal, that really opened up the world of, wow, there were more than these action figures out there, and there were prototypes, and there were toys that were never produced, and there's paperwork and plans and all this kinds of stuff that gets into the history of toy. And we set off a whole new era of collecting. And at that time, pop culture collecting was becoming big, and kids who had grown up with Howdy Doody in the 50s and a lot of the other TV shows were interested in those things, because it was the 50s shows that and the 60s shows that started generating toys and toy commercials on these shows. You know, see see the Batman animated series, and they had commercials for the Batman toys before they cracked down on those. And so it was this whole phenomenon that started very slowly in the 50s and 60s and 70s, and then things got quiet for a while, and then, you know, with all this income that they had as they were growing up, we saw people going into toy collecting as a hobby.
It's funny because I'm on the other end of that. I remember being freshman in college, 1991, going to a comic book store with my friend. In the back, they had a whole counter of vintage Star Wars toys, and it clicked. You know, something in me snapped. You know, people call it coming out of the dark ages. And I was like, wait, people collect these. I'm allowed to buy these. And I was, 19 at the time. I remember buying the, you know, whatever, the toy collecting magazines. And that opened up right. me buying toys as a quasi-adult at that point. And that is exactly the year where you were publishing that. It was like a zeitgeist moment of you doing that and people of my age earning a little bit of money and having, you know, a space to do that with.
I had an aha moment in the 1980s, early 1980s. I worked on a book called for Starlog magazine, which was a great magazine that really was at the forefront of the whole science fiction revolution. Started publishing in 1976, so they were right there for the turn into, you know, Star Wars opened up the field for so many science fiction movies, for Star Trek as a movie, and things like that. But I did this photo guidebook of science fiction toys and models for Starlog magazine that came out in 1980. And I worked with a guy named Bob Burns, who has this amazing collection in the Los Angeles area. And Bob had old toys that he bought in the 50s and 60s, you know, on the shelves, new. And the book with a guy named Mike Miner, who's no longer with us. He was an assistant art director for the first Star Trek movie and art director for the second Star Trek movie. And he made little sets, and we kept setting up the toys and some of my toys. We got in Star Wars toys, and I said to him, my God, if I only had, and he has the original Time Machine from the movie. And I sat in it at his house. It was incredible. And I'm thinking, if only I had a real time machine and could go back into the 50s and start buying these toys new like you did. And here's the, you know, the Robbie atomic space car, you know, that you bought for $5 and now sells for $1,000, and I can't afford that, but I love the toy so much. If only I had this time machine. And then something clicked, and it was, well, wait a second. Suppose I'm thinking about Star Wars, and the time machine has deposited me in 1979, 1980, and the toys are new in the store, and I can buy them at retail price, and I love this stuff. And so, in effect, I was in my time machine and sort of looking ahead and seeing 10 years from now, I'm going to be really happy that I was in my time machine and was there at the time this stuff was new and accessible. And I had started buying Star Wars stuff when it came out in the stores in 1977. The first action figures didn't come out till 1978. But when I had this sort of awakening when we were preparing the book in 1979, I went back to the toy stores and bought older stock that was still on the shelves. There were lots of independent toy stores. And so I thought, well, this is a way fill in my Star Wars collection, but I also had a space toy collection that was bigger than the Star Wars collection at the time. That's all gone now, but I had this other collection, and I would go into the back rooms of these independent toy stores where they had old toys from the 70s and 80s, Major Matt Mason from Mattel, and just original stuff, and I would buy all the space stuff that they had. So here was my time machine working for me, and eventually, in selling all those space toys through eBay and other places, I got more money to buy my Star Wars collection.
Where do you go from that understanding of, because I remember it was 1985, we had a baseball card business on the side, and we went to a baseball card show, and another kid I knew, you know, it's like, oh, you know, look, and at 1885, he was showing me his Star Wars want list. And I remember he had like MIB, Mitten Box, and I'm still a kid at the time. And it just blew my mind that you would get a Star Wars toy and not open it. But for you, where was that? Where was the moment where you realized, well, there's the toys, the stuff, the mail-in exclusive, the figures, the obvious stuff. But then where did you get into the idea of, like you were saying, there's prototypes, there's molds, there's store displays, and I don't even know what else. When did that hit your radar? Because that feels like there was a period where there's a bit of the Wild West, and someone like you saw it before other people and sought it out when other people were literally throwing that stuff away.
Well, that was in the 1980s. And there was this publication called TKRP, a guy named Tom Kennedy, who was a disc jockey in, I think, Louisville at the time. And he advertised in the back of like Starlog magazine or something like that. And he was frustrated because he couldn't find all of the Star Wars stuff that he wanted to collect. And it was not just toys, but it was the sheets and pillowcases and deck of plastics for serving ware and all that kind of stuff. And so he would buy wholesale, and he would have to buy a certain amount of stuff. And so he had a list, and he would sell this stuff to Star Wars fans all over the country. And I got on his, I got his first list, and I started buying this stuff. And then I found out there were dealers, and there were these mimeographed and photocopied lists that came from hundreds of small dealers around the U.S. And they were selling all this stuff that I couldn't find anywhere. And then I would see things like store displays. And I would go into stores and ask them for store displays. And sometimes you get somebody say, well, George Lucas himself comes by and picks these up after we're finished with them. So I got that any number of times, and so did a lot of other people. Or Lucasfilm demands that we send these back. You know, they were keeping them themselves but didn't want to say so. But I would still get lots of store displays that way. And you could buy store displays from other people who were able to get them from stores. And so it was not just the material, but it was not just the stuff that was sold, but the stuff that promoted this, the things that were sold. I went to professional toy shows for toy dealers. I was able to do that because I was writing stories about toys and things like that. So through the journal, I got on the list of going to a toy show in Southern California. They did a version of the New York Toy Fair on a much smaller basis, but that's where I got to meet the reps from Kenner Products who were doing the Star Wars toys and would collect their Toy Fair catalogs, which are, you know, just history in beautiful color pictures of what was available, including their store displays and things of that nature. And so it just became this expansive world. And I would go to Toys R Us maybe twice a week and go to my little corner neighborhood toy store. I can't tell you how important the independent toy stores were back then because of all this other stuff that was available, and they would get things that some of the big chains like Toys R Us didn't carry.
What was the range of reactions you got? Because, again, we had a stamp business in the 70s, a baseball card in the 80s, so I was aware of memorabilia, but also the fact that you're grown men playing with, you know, these little pieces of cards. And in the 80s, everyone knew baseball cards worthwhile. Toys, I don't remember in the same way. I remember that as, I mean, I'm curious of the reaction, because again, now everyone's like, I'd like to go back to 1980 and do that. But at the time, people who like Star Trek and sci-fi and the conventions, it was so much different. Did you get reactions where people didn't get it? They were confused?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
I mean, undoubtedly the reaction from the cashiers you must be having a birthday party, or, oh, your son must love Star Wars. Oh, you're, you know, it was, and I I must admit, I didn't say, oh no, this stuff's all for me. It was a little bit embarrassing when they put you on the spot like that. And I wasn't brave enough to say, you know, it was, no, I have a big collection of Star Wars stuff. You know, it was many years later when people started to recognize me. It's, oh, you're the Star Wars guy. It happens every time I go into my Hallmark shop. We have some new Star Wars stuff for you, Steve. So it was an evolving kind of situation. And not until that first book came out in 92 that I feel more comfortable about sort of coming out of the closet, so to speak, on my Star Wars collecting.
So I always remember hearing, or I remember reading or videos of stories, and I don't remember if it was you or not. And you can put the boundaries here where you need to, but it's always the idea of like dumpster diving. And I remember hearing stories, and again, I have no idea if this was connected to you or not, or the people who made connections at Kenner, or the people literally who would dumpster dive. What is that? Is there anything you could say about that type of thing? Because that's, again, this idea where it's someone who finds value where other people find trash, but it takes a real sense of bravery, a real sense of nuance, because you might have to know people to say, oh, if you're throwing out the paperwork of your sketches, like, you know, let me know. What was that end of it like?
Well, there is a famous case of dumpster diving at Kenner, which they didn't find out about for a couple of years. And there was a guy in Cincinnati who dumpster dived at Kenner early on, loved the Star Wars stuff, and I think he took out other stuff too, but they would throw away printer's proofs, card backs that they did, you know, printer's card backs that they didn't need, that they didn't use. I mean, he came out of that with an extensive collection of multiples of things that then he was able to make a business out of. Also, a really nice guy, very friendly guy. He has given some interviews about this, so he's sort of come out of the closet. When Kenner finally realized what was going on after a couple of years, they put up chain link fences with locks and things like that. But what the hell? They were throwing this stuff away. You know, why shouldn't other people enjoy it? And then there was somebody who worked at Kenner who was also a big fan of the Star Wars stuff. And that's how you really get stuff, is you have somebody on the inside. And they would give him the things that they were going to throw away. The uncut proofs for packaging and the chromalins, which is one stage in the color printing process. And so much of that stuff was saved for posterity by this one individual in Cincinnati who worked for Kenner. And, you know, he was able to send his kids through. First of all, it was his personal collection. And then he decided he had to send his kids to college, and he was able to do that based on selling this stuff.
So are there any early, I'm just curious, like the first kind of like score, the early or an early one where you're like, ooh, I found this, or that sort of thing that you came up with? Or was it just, it was all so new that anything you got felt like you're adding to the collection? There was no real sense of what was a big score versus a small score.
No, in the late 80s, you know, Star Wars sort of went off the rails around 85, 86. The product stopped coming out. This is the dark period from 85, 86 to about 94. And this was a time when many people who had started collecting Star Wars, and there were some really big collectors, some major collectors back then. And I met some of them at the 10th anniversary Star Wars convention in Los Angeles. So it was 1987. And there was one guy back in the Philadelphia area or the Pittsburgh area, whose name I'm blanking on right now, who worked for the phone company. And he and his wife were getting a divorce. But Kenner had actually used him at a toy fair at the New York Toy Fair International in 1983, and they put on a display of his Star Wars toys. I mean, Kenner didn't have a loose Star Wars toys to put on display, and this guy did. Walt Steuben, that was his name. And they used him, and he got all kinds of media attention. There were newspaper stories and video stuff on the TV news. But Walt had to sell his collection because they had to monetize it for the divorce. Well, that happened to three major collections.
Oh, wow.
And I was there for each of them. And so I did not buy the complete collections, but I managed to get a lot of stuff from each of these sales of stuff. I increased my poster collection by hundreds of posters in one of these sales, and I think that was from Walt Steuben's collection. I mean, he more than me at the time was just after everything and internationally, and that was a whole market that just was a very quiet market and really was not very highly prized by U.S. collectors until years later. And now local, for example, Mexico and the Lily Lady figures, it was the Kenner affiliate in Mexico. And all of the prices of all of these international figures have just gone sky high and totally out of, you know, most people's price range. But that was a more recent phenomenon as it sort of spread from the U.S. and became a worldwide phenomenon. But the ability to get a part of other people's collections was really sized up my collection quite a bit. And then I had the chance in the late 80s to buy some actual models from Gary Kurtz, who was the producer of Star Wars and The Empire Strikes Back. And Gary was in charge of getting ILM, Industrial Light and Magic, in the model shop to produce pieces that were used as gifts for, you know, major vendors and things like that. Well, he had a collection of, my God, there were a dozen or more models that he moved to London, but he kept them in storage in Southern California. And I heard through a third party and then traced it back another step that Gary was going to sell his collection, and he was selling it through a friend who happened to be the first head of the Star Wars fan club when it became internal to Lucasfilm in 1979. And or 1978, and I went over to this guy's house. He had all these amazing things. There was a framework for the full-size Millennium Falcon that they built for The Empire Strikes Back, and there were models of X-wing fighters and speeder bikes and just all kinds of stuff, and I said, well, let me think about it. And he gave me some idea of the prices and everything. And I thought, and he said, okay, well, let me know as soon as you can. You're the first one to see this stuff, which one you would like to buy. And I went home that night and I couldn't sleep. And I thought, this is a once in a lifetime opportunity. And if I pass this up, I will never forgive myself. And so the next day I started calling about refinancing my house. Got a second mortgage for the first time and bought the entire collection. Yeah, so you make those decisions, those life-altering decisions, and many of those pieces have since left the collection in trades or sales, but they enabled me to buy other things, and it was probably the best investment I ever made in my life.
Wow. So this brings us to the other part of your story. And this is what's so great is you had a, generally speaking, I believe like 30-year career as a journalist, working mostly for the Wall Street Journal.
I started out of school at the Philadelphia Inquirer and worked there for 3.5 years interrupted by military service. I joined the, that was back in the Vietnam era. I was in the Air Force Reserve and then the Air National Guard, so 6 years of service. But it was service that also, after my 6 months of basic training, let me work full time, except for 3 weeks in the summer and one weekend every month for 6 years. And then I went to the Wall Street Journal in 1969 in the Philadelphia Bureau, was there for 2.5 years, then Montreal, and then went out to, was transferred to Los Angeles in 1973. So I had a 29-year career at the Journal, or 26-year career at the Journal, the last 9 of which I was bureau chief in the Los Angeles Bureau, and we had a bureau that at one point reached 18 reporters. So it was... and here I was collecting Star Wars stuff on the side. So it kept, it was a very busy life.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen a, you know, I guess it was an earlier mid-90s video where, you know, TV show came in and they go to the Journal and they ask for you. And that's something that really, you know, it really spoke to me, this idea that here you are, bureau chief, you've got an office, you have a lot of responsibility. It's for, you know, extraordinarily prominent publication. And that's the type of job that would eat someone's entire life. It's a difficult job. It's an interesting job. It requires a certain set of skill. And yet here you have this passion to carve out your own space. Was the collecting something you kept secret for a period of time? What was that like, this idea of having a double life? And that's because I work with a lot of writers and artists, and often they hide it because people don't understand, or they worry that people will be threatened by it. What was it like for you?
No, at that point, when I moved out to Los Angeles in 1973, and then, of course, the collecting started after that. And so I had a lovely house in the hills on stilts, cantilevered house, and my collection started growing. And at first, I would buy the things and take Polaroid pictures of them and put them in boxes and wrap the boxes in big garbage bags and store them under the neighbor's unfinished house, you know, on dirt, basically. And then 1 year they said, Steve, we're going to be building out the house downstairs, so you're going to have to move your stuff. At which point I decided to add a second floor underneath my main living area. And 2 years later, added a third floor. So the one-story cantilevered house became a three-story cantilevered house. There were many refinancings of the mortgage, as you can tell. But I would have people from the Journal over for parties or just to visit and things like that. So they knew I was collecting a lot of this stuff, mainly the space toys and then the Star Wars thing. And they knew I was crazy about Star Wars. And so it was never a secret. I was always open about that in the workplace with colleagues.
Did you have I'm always thinking of immediate family or even extended family, brothers, sisters, parents, or, you know, I don't know your personal situation at the time. Was that something that was part of almost a negotiation? The idea where you have people who are close to you, the friends kind of get it and that sort of thing, but people who are family, who are maybe more of a part of it or maybe don't get it, was that something you had to navigate as well?
It was not really a problem. My partner of 43 years was very understanding. He does not collect really very much stuff, but this was my thing. And it was always, it was never even a subject of discussion. It was my money, it was my passion, and it was my hobby. And so it was never a bone of contention. And as far as my family goes, they were all back in Philadelphia. So they would come out and they would see stuff. But again, and my nieces and nephews, oh, well, that's crazy Uncle Steve and his toys.
I, that is so inspiring to me too, because, you know, one of the many things that draws me to your story is that clarity of passion. And to me, it's always seems so wrapped in joy and community. And it's so wonderful when you're, you know, in a situation where that is just recognized and it's okay. And I think when we look at maybe a famous creator, we sometimes see that because of how big that's created. I just think that's such a special thing to have been the environment that you're a part of. I think that's amazing.
I got into a little trouble once, and that was when I started doing QVC television shows. I did 50 hours of QVC Star Wars collectibles shows while I started doing them while I was still at the Journal in 1994. I had written the book. They had put the book on TV. I called up and got to talk to the host, a guy named Steve Bryant, who was great and a Star Wars fan himself. And then they invited me to actually do one of the shows, to come on as a guest. They had Mark Hamill on, but you know, they could get me a lot cheaper than Mark Hamill. It was an outside company that was packaging the shows for QVC, at least initially, and coming up with the merchandise, the exclusive merchandise. And this was an area where Star Wars was just starting to be merchandisable again. And so they were on the cusp of what was about to become a fairly big phenomenon, although it would take years to build it up and become more than just, the merchandise is out there for a year while the movie is still playing. So I was on the show and the first time, and they introduced me as Steve Sansweet, the writer of the Star Wars book, and he's bureau chief of the he's a deputy bureau chief of the Wall Street Journal, I guess, at the time. In Los Angeles, and I got a call from my boss, and he said, you can't be introduced as, I mean, this is a little tacky. And I say, well, the Washington bureau chief is on Washington Week in Review, and he's introduced as being from the Wall Street Journal. And then, Steve, can you compare Washington Week in Review with QVC? I said, well, not exactly, but it's there's equity in it. So the agreement was that I could keep doing the show, but I wouldn't be introduced as a Wall Street Journal person. And I said, well, that's fine. They don't need to introduce me as a Wall Street Journal person. But that's where a lot of people got to virtually meet me. And know about me was through the QVC shows. As I said, I did approximately between 1994 and 1999, 50 hours of shows, usually four or five times a year. We'd do a two-hour special, and then sometimes there'd be an hour overnight show. And I would bring the entertainment part of, I would be the number two, the second banana. And although I just got in touch with this Steve Bryan again after all of these years, and I said, it was great being your second banana. And he said, no, you were the first banana. I was there to sell the stuff. Of course, my enthusiasm about the stuff was real. And so some of the stuff I would recommend, some of the stuff I would see for the first time when I got there, some of the stuff I really desperately wanted to buy before they sold it out because there was a limited amount. It was very cool. And people, that's the first time anybody ever stopped me. People would stop me, you know, in the shopping center or at a concert or something like that and say, you're the guy from QVC. Yeah, it was a little embarrassing, but it was fun.
So this is the same era where you made that big career shift where you left the Journal and you went inside Lucasfilm. Is that correct?
Well, as Joseph Campbell, the wonderful author and influencer wrote some wonderful books about mythology and how mythology spreads around the world and how our foundational stories are so similar and in different cultures. he said, follow your bliss. And I did. And I had been bureau chief for 9 years at the Journal at that point, and it was time for me to do something different. The Journal offered me they needed to have somebody new in Los Angeles because I was holding up the opportunity for other people to move ahead. And the normal time for a bureau chief is 3 to 4 years, and here I've been holding it for 9. So I must have been doing something right. But they offered an assignment back in New York. They offered to make me a super reporter. They offered a job. They were starting up a local edition of the Journal, and I didn't think that would last long, and it didn't. But I got a call from Lucasfilm, and of course I knew the people at Lucasfilm because I had interviewed a lot of the people for my first book, and I was working on other books. I was then working on an encyclopedia, the first Star Wars encyclopedia. I had done two Star Wars price guides with another publishing company. And so I knew the people. I had interviewed George for a couple of hours for the first book. And they called, the head of publicity called and said, Steve, we're wondering if you might be able to recommend somebody. We're looking for a person that we can control, that we hire, although the job would be paid for by 20th Century Fox, and it's a one-year job only, and it's to go around the country and talk to fans about what's going on with the special editions, which were coming out in 1997. And so this was in 95, and they were already looking to have somebody in 96 go out. And there were people who did that kind of things for the movie companies, but usually there was a guy named Jeff Walker, and he had the trailer park, and he would represent a bunch of movie companies, and they would go to a convention like San Diego Comic-Con, and they would play trailers. It's not anything like it is today when you bring in all the stars, the biggest stars go to say, I mean, if Harrison Ford can go to San Diego Comic-Con, you know, anybody can go to San Diego Comic-Con. So it's become a whole amazing thing. But back in the mid 90s, it was a much smaller kind of basis. And they said, you know, we're looking for somebody to do maybe 8 to 10 conventions in the year. Well, I ended up taking the job, although they kept saying 1 year only guaranteed, there is no chance that we're going to continue this job. And then they sort of forgot about it for 15 years. Obviously, I had proved my worth, and I did about 40 conventions instead of 8 to 10 that year, and talked about the special editions. And they had this multimedia product called Shadows of the Empire, which was everything but a movie, and just got to meet fans from all over. It was just a wonderful experience. And then they were starting up and I was still working out of my house in LA. Of course, Lucasfilm was in Northern California. And they were starting up a marketing department. And they said, well, there's a possibility that whoever we hire for head of marketing would want to have you on the staff. So we'll keep you on the payroll until that happens. Well, that kept getting put off until the spring of 1997. And I was still on the payroll and still living in LA. And the new guy named Jim Ward, came in from an outside ad agency, brilliant guy, and really tough, but brilliant. And he decided to keep me on. So although I didn't move up to Northern California until the summer of 98, so I commuted every week from Southern California to Northern California, had a corporate apartment, and we made it work.
It's funny because that seems like the precursor to what you see now. You know, you go on YouTube, you go on podcasts, and there are these fan communities, and they're really run by fans, which is different than what I remember from the 70s, 80s, and 90s, where it was, you know, a big media thing, and they'd almost make fun a little bit, you know, and they were just some person.
I would go to conventions, especially internationally. If I would go to the UK or to Australia and do a radio show to promote a fan convention, undoubtedly I'd get called a nutter or an anorak, which is a windbreaker that train spotters wear. And so it's become, you know, fanatic kind of thing. And I had to defend myself, but they would have fun on those things. Well, that doesn't exist anymore with the communities of influencers that we have that are fans themselves, but are now making money out of this thing. It has really changed remarkably.
When the special editions came out, again, I'm just of that fan age where that was a watershed moment because you could sort of see Star Wars in the theater again. And it was like, you know, if you're someone like me at the time, you're in your 20s, it was like a time warp. And then, you know, 20s are a time you're finding yourself and to go back to that. And my memory is that everything changed for Star Wars after that. It's that they understood the financial value, the merchandising. I have no idea when they started planning the prequels and all that. But from there until now, it seems to have just been a steam train that has only picked up speed. Was that what it felt like to you, where you went from, wow, here I was, the guy on the outside, and it was me and our weird little band of people, and now it's just bigger and bigger every year?
Yeah, well, I sort of saw a preview of that going out to the fan conventions in 96 and saw the enthusiasm of a lot of college-age kids. And these were kids who had never seen Star Wars in the theater, or who maybe were old enough to have seen Return of the Jedi when they were four years old. And it was funny because I would ask the audiences, you know, what's your favorite Star Wars movie? And I expected either Star Wars or Empire. And then I would see a lot of hands for Return of the Jedi, and it turns out this was the first movie. This was their Star Wars movie. It was the first movie they had seen in the theater, and so. But the enthusiasm was tremendous. I always got really large audiences. This was the first time that Lucasfilm actually was presenting something, and so people were very interested to see it. We had trailers, we had special sneak peeks of footage from the special editions, and people were very excited and very energized by the whole thing.
It's interesting to think about the generational aspect, because I watch a really silly amount of YouTube. And what's interesting is that later on when the prequels came out, there's a generation now that are in their 20s and 30s now where, as you were saying, that was their Star Wars. People of my generation tend to have varying viewpoints of those movies. But it's interesting that because of those movies, there is this thriving ecosystem of people at many ages. And it's, as you're saying, they kind of had their moment to be introduced to it. And it sort of took hold. I'm curious your take on it. It's still a funny thing to me to say, you know, oh, it's the Star Wars community and all of that. What does it mean to have a community around something like this? And you've seen it from a perspective that I just haven't. I'm just the average fan, so I get it from that level. But to see how it affects people, how they wait in line, how they show up at Celebration or whatever event it's going to be, what is that?
Well, waiting in line for 2 months before the tickets go on sale, I mean, talk about craziness. But that's part of the lure, reading a story like that, seeing the kind of publicity that it gets. Kenner Products wasn't able to send out its action figures out in the market for Christmas of 1977, so they basically had an empty box, a cardboard portfolio, and they got nailed by the media, by TV, by newspapers writing nasty stories about this, but they let people know that action figures were coming out. And it was like, I don't care what you say about me, spell my name right. And so that whole phenomenon has continued. People love or they don't love certain Star Wars movies, but they talk about it and they're verbal about it. And there's the group, the original trilogy group, the prequels group, the sequels group, the TV people who love the Clone Wars and Rebels and it's amazing. There are all sorts of entry points into Star Wars now, and The Mandalorian just showed what it could do for Disney and for Star Wars. Who knew that the child, Baby Yoda, would become the celebrity of the year? I mean, it's just incredible to see that. And internally at Lucasfilm in the 90s and 2000s, they were very much thinking about making Star Wars, as far as the merchandise goes, a year-round product, sort of like a Barbie doll or a Hot Toys or something like that, not just as most movie toys come out right before, you know, in Target, you see them 4 to 6 weeks before the movie opens, and then they're gone within a month or so. They're 40% off by the time the movie opens. Well, the whole idea was to make Star Wars a stable product that would work all year, every year. And they've succeeded in doing that because there's demand for it. And you see all kinds of different merchandise. You see Yadro porcelain pieces for $2,500 out there, way beyond what I can afford these days. But there's just something for everybody.
So something I've thought a lot about, because again, I've watched, you know, all these collectors on YouTube, is where is that line between hoarding and collecting? And I watched a really good podcast where two collectors talked about this, and behind one of them were, and this is a very common thing I'd see for an average collector, all these Rubbermaid containers stacked up, and they're talking about, this was just announced, and they're everything that came out, they kept buying it. And in my mind, I know it's the hunt. They're buying it because the hunt, it's new. But when you see that they've been hunting for years, and this, I mean, this is sort of almost a funny thing. I still go into independent toy stores and see the late 90s figures still for sale for retail because everyone bought them. They didn't really increase in value, the normal ones.
Right.
Where is that line? And you're not the normal collector, but where is that line in what you see between this is healthy, this is people who love it and they're collecting it, versus this is maybe too much, they're hoarding it, or people are chasing value, they're buying it only because they want to flip it at some point, and oh, that used to be the case, but for 90% of what's created, that will never happen. Do you have any perspective on that almost financial aspect of collecting?
Well, I think the hoarding becomes a problem if you're spending money that you really need for rent or mortgage or to put away to send the kid to college. You know, if your partner or spouse really needs more money to fix the house up, and all that money is gone. I don't see a lot of that. There's another kind of thing which we call hoarding, which the figures and cases, because people just don't have room enough to put things out, or they're buying. That indicates probably that they're buying too much. Mm-hmm. And whether they're doing that because they think they can flip it, or, I mean, there's a psychological problem with that. But I don't think that that is very common. And you look at a lot of the Facebook groups, and people will show pictures of how they display Star Wars. There's something going on the last 2 weeks on a group that I follow, and people are showing these amazing displays, sometimes in big basements or garages, and the beautiful cases and backlights, and interspersed with posters or great art. So the hoarding, I've known some hoarders in my life, and people who would buy things or put them away on layaway and try to get them after a fashion, and then couldn't afford food. I mean, I know really sorry cases, but very rare, I think. And I think the sense of community and the ability now to see other people and what other people do, you don't have very much of this kind of hoarding that you would find, you know, the pickers going to a jacked open storage locker and seeing, you know, $100,000 worth of Star Wars toys.
Yeah.
It's probably not going to happen.
So I want to sort of finish and really what, you know, what you're known for now, which is Rancho Obi-Wan. You have a museum, essentially. This is a museum. It's a, your memorabilia collection that you, during normal times, welcome people in to tour. You give tours, other people give tours. What was the impetus to say this is worthy of a museum? And not only that, that you want to do that, that you want to figure out how to make the space, host it. What was that process like? Because that's a whole other way of thinking about your lifestyle with something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it started with looking for a place in Northern California that was not only a nice house, but had enough property that I could do something with for my collection. And I ended up buying a house that was off the market. It had been on the market shortly, but had so many problems that they took it off the market and would have gone into foreclosure. But it had giant chicken barns that up until the 1970s had housed 25,000 egg-laying hens. Petaluma was really big in the chicken and egg business. And so when we moved up here in 98, the first thing, the house was in great shape. The house had been redone about 10 years before. And the barn needed, the first barn needed to be redone. And so I spent my money in fixing up the barn, and mainly making it a nice warehouse that I could have friends over and see. Because part of the fact was, here I was, head of fan relations for Lucasfilm, started meeting and becoming friends with people all over the world, and they knew I collected and had a major collection. And I wanted them to see it. I wanted to share it with people. That was part of my joy and my excitement in collecting. And one of the reasons that I still collect, I think, is to be able to share some of the cool stuff with people. I can't have everything. I used to consider myself the completist. And I'm still the completist in terms of I would like to have everything, but I sure as hell can't afford it. I'm retired. The museum doesn't bring in very much money. I take a small income out of it. It costs me more than it brings in. We try to keep it going. So there's 9,000 square feet of space with an addition that we added. And we got contacted by Guinness in 2013, I guess, or two, no, 2000, yeah, 2013. And said, we think you may have the largest collection in the world. And I said, duh. Yeah, you think? And so we got in the Guinness book of the 2014 book, and we were on the Guinness site for the world's largest collection, even though the inventory database at that point only had 94,000 items. We probably have about 400,000 or so items, separate items in the collection. But sharing it with people, and people have come here from Vietnam, from Russia, from Dubai, from New Zealand, Canada, all over the world. And it's great to meet these people and to share the passion and to have them know that this is a legitimate kind of thing. Of course, Lucasfilm is not too unhappy about that. And Lucasfilm was not too unhappy about a Wall Street Journal reporter writing a book in 1992 that talked about collecting, or how Star Wars got from an idea in George's mind to how it got translated to the screen to then how the merchandise came out. And the merchandise is such a major part of what has made Star Wars a phenomenon and what makes it continue 40 plus years later as this amazing phenomenon. And of course, Disney adding parks, parts of parks, and keeping the merchandise going and adding TV series. All of that is part of, and fans sharing in this. And from the start, Lucasfilm letting fans share in this. There's always been a couple of rough spots, but Star Wars fans are passionate about making things in the Star Wars universe. Artists and modelers and costumers, and unlike in the early days, fanzines, writing fan fiction. Unlike any other of the genre properties, unlike Star Trek, unlike, I mean, there's some of this for all of this, Lord of the Rings, the Marvel movies, but Star Wars is the king when it comes to all of this shared passion of Star Wars and shared creativity and wanting to do your own thing when it comes to Star Wars and taking part of that and being able to play in George Lucas's sandbox.
I love that. We covered a lot. Is there anything I haven't asked about that you think we should definitely cover with any of this?
Well, right now, as you said, we're not able to do tours, obviously, because of the pandemic. So we rushed into something we started to think about a couple of years ago, and we now have a Rancho Obi-Wan virtual museum. And so we have different subscription levels. We do lots of videos behind the scenes. I give some of my life story in some of the videos at certain levels. We have photographs, and it's a way of supporting us. And we also have a subscription, an annual subscription, which supports Rancho Obi-Wan. And you get a really nice kit with an annual patch and a pin and a letter and all kinds of stuff like that. So, I mean, we can use fan support these days. We have a very active fan base. And things are a little tight right now because of the pandemic, just like for any other nonprofit. So, but it's amazing. I mean, the fans, my fellow fans are amazing. And of course, I'm a fan myself. And that's what makes it work.
Steve, thank you so much for taking the time. Everything about this story is inspiring to me. And I appreciate your taking the time to share it with us.
My pleasure, Dan.
You can find Steve Sansweet at RanchoObiWan.org. That is Rancho, R-A-N-C-H-O, and then Obi-Wan, O-B-I-W-A-N.org. They have a Facebook page. As I believe he mentioned, they have a virtual museum subscription. You can totally check that out on their site, experience the entirety of his collection and the museum experience wherever you are in the world. On Twitter, they are Rancho Obi-Wan, and Steve himself is at Steve Sansweet. Over on Instagram, it is Rancho Obi-Wan, and of course, they have a YouTube channel as well. My name again is Dan Blank. You can find me at Dan Blank on social media or on my website, wegrowmedia.com. If you enjoyed this episode or any other, please consider leaving a rating over on Apple Podcasts. Thank you so much for listening until the end.